Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, as always. And today, I have a great guest. Now, I'm sure you may know Brian Clark from his days at CSBA, but now he's a senior fellow at Hudson, and he's continuing to do the great work he's always done. And today, we were going to talk about a range of things. We're going to talk a little bit about NATO, maybe some implications of nuclear modernization in the Asia Pacific. And we wanted to get Brian's take on these topics. We've never had him on NucleCast before, so it's great to finally have him. So welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
So, you know, we had the NATO's Washington summit here recently. We've had it, two countries have joined, spending amongst NATO member states is up, thanks to Vladimir Putin and the Russians. NATO is solidly funding the effort by the Ukrainians to thwart a Russian victory. There's, Vladimir Putin has had over 2 years of nuclear threats. And so there's a lot going on in Europe. It's not a dull time. And then, of course, we're seeing Chinese aggression increasing against Taiwan. And, of course, the South Koreans are worried. The Japanese are worried. The Philippines is worried. There's just a lot going on. So as you have been conducting, frequent analysis of these various topics, how do you see the developments and where you think they're taking both the United States and our allies?
Yeah, Adam, that's a good question. I think one of the challenges that the U.S. faces is that the threats to itself and its allies are growing. Particularly in the nuclear realm, where you have China now massively expanding its own nuclear inventory. That's going to mean that the U.S. might need to think about new approaches to deterring Chinese weapons attack, nuclear attack. You've got Russia becoming increasingly belligerent and threatening nuclear attacks as part of an escalation doctrine that they're carrying out against Ukraine. And you've got new players such as Iran that are close to fielding a nuclear weapon. All of them are posing threats in addition to North Korea to the United States and its allies abroad. And the U.S. has traditionally had a model of extended deterrence where we would offer a nuclear umbrella to these countries and try to protect them or retaliate on their behalf if they're attacked with nuclear weapons. And as the threats to each of these allies grow, it might mean that the U.S. is getting pulled in multiple different directions in terms of how does it deter those potential aggressors. In the past, we were able to do that with our single nuclear triad, which was composed mostly of long-range missiles deployed from submarines and from shore, from land bases, and then kind of supplemented with bomber-delivered missiles or bombs. But for the most part, it was the long-range missiles that provided that nuclear deterrent. And they could reach anywhere on the planet, and in theory, they could defend any of the United States' allies against Russian aggression mostly, but then Chinese aggression as well, and North Korean aggression as well. The challenge, though, now is some of these threats are morphing into threats of small-scale nuclear attack, or in terms of nuclear electromagnetic pulse weapons, where you use a nuclear weapon to generate an electromagnetic pulse. So ways of using nuclear weapons that are not the sort of large-scale catastrophic attack that the U.S. has been preparing for, which might mean you need different ways to deter that because Russia may not find it credible that the U.S. would mount a large-scale attack from the U.S. homeland against Russia, and China may feel the same way, in retaliation for a small nuclear strike by Russia or China. So the lack of credibility might be a problem. So the U.S. has to think about Do we need a more diverse nuclear portfolio that includes larger numbers of smaller weapons that are more tactically deployed rather than strategically deployed? So the growing number and a range of threats on the nuclear side are really driving the U.S. to have to think differently about how to recapitalize the nuclear complex, which is currently underway.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but I wonder, you know, we the United States are not really in a position where, even if we wanted to, let's suppose we say, hey, you know, there's some event and we say, hey, we've got to massively or even moderately increase the number of weapons because we need to, let's say we need theater nuclear weapons, which I think is probably our greatest need. It's where we really have the, you know, a mismatch. We couldn't produce the pits we need. We'd have to use old pits and hope they still work. You know, the DOE complex is sort of in this process of a very slow recapitalization. You know, nothing's coming online when it was scheduled to. You know, pits are sort of the focus of a lot of this. But there's just so many problems in terms of both physical infrastructure, building the weapons. You know, we're 15 years into modernization and have really very little to show for it yet, not a new system. But like you mentioned, the Chinese, you know, they'll surpass the size of the U.S. arsenal within the next 10 years. And it's just, it's not really looking good for the United States. It seems like we've lost our WASTA. Do you see the United States as able to sort of, you know, get back on the horse? You know, they're saying, oh, there's an arms race, but the U.S. is sitting in the stands watching the Chinese, the Russians and the North Koreans, and maybe the Iranians are going to join in on that. Are we going to get out there and run this race, or are we just going to sit and watch?
I think, like you said, there's multiple aspects of this that'll be difficult. One is just the expense of recapitalizing the triad that we currently have is breaking the bank on the defense budget. The Sentinel program is already well over its original estimate. We're up to about $100 billion for the program. It's probably going to go higher than that. The Columbia program overall is about the same amount, which will field the current generation Trident missiles. And then there's also the LRSO program, long range strike option, which is the Air Force nuclear equipped missile, which will replace the ALCM. And so these programs, just to recapitalize what we have, is running into $300 billion or so, probably by the end of the day, in terms of just procurement and R&D. And that's stressing the services' conventional arms budgets. So we're having to shrink the number of ships that we buy, shrink the number of aircraft we buy, in part because of the need to recapitalize that nuclear complex. So then if you add to it potentially investment in infrastructure like weapons production facilities to make new pits and testing facilities to be able to understand whether the new or old pits are workable, that's a lot of investment that runs into the billions of dollars as well. And there's no clear way for that money to be made available unless we cut some more from the conventional side of the house. So I think what the U.S. is likely to do is come up with a scheme where we maybe don't recapitalize the triad completely as planned, and that we recapitalize it in part and then use some of the money left over to invest in some of these other nuclear weapons form factors that might be necessary to deter other forms of nuclear aggression. An alternative idea would be not recapitalize the triad in full and devote more of that money to conventional capabilities that could be used as a way of retaliating or deterring nuclear attack. For example, if you're going to use a nuclear EMP against a U.S. ally, we're going to retaliate with cyber attacks, and we've invested in the infrastructure to do that. But you'd have to demonstrate that in the same way that you can demonstrate a nuclear weapon. So I think there's challenges with moving to a conventional-only approach because you have to demonstrate that it has the same effectiveness as a nuclear weapon. But I think the U.S. has limited options given the likely budget constraints it's going to be under due to just the uprising cost of all the other aspects of government spending. So it's not a matter of political will. It's just a matter of how much will the market bear in terms of U.S. deficit spending. And they'll reach kind of a practical limit. And I think we're getting close to that in the current interest rate regime that may change going forward, but there's not a whole lot of wiggle room there. So we can't massively increase the investment in nuclear weapons without impacting conventional recapitalization right now.
Yeah, I mean, I often hear people say that, you know, nuclear modernization is breaking the bank, but, you know, it's 7% of the defense budget. So that's a reasonable amount. I mean, historically, during the Cold War, it was half the defense budget. And it was half the defense budget at a time when we had over 600 B-52s that were fielded at bases. And, you know, now we've got 46 nuclear capable B-52s, and we've got, you know, for ICBMs we've got 400 instead of several thousand, and yet we somehow can't afford it. We can't afford to modernize it, and then at the same time, you know, in a $6.5 trillion federal budget, in which, you know, the U.S. actually took in $4.5 trillion and borrowed $2 trillion. You know, if you look at that budget, it's not the defense budget that's the fundamental problem. It's domestic spending and entitlements. And so I always hear, you know, constrain the defense budget and we're going to have to. But at some point, you got to stop giving people free stuff in order to, you know, defend the nation as a whole. That's a choice that you eventually have to make. As you've expanded domestic spending while cutting defense spending, you may have to move it the opposite direction. And I wonder, you know, can whether it's, you know, Kamala Harris or whether it's Donald Trump, is there a president who can say, hey, break, guys, we're going to have to rebalance our defense priorities or our spending priorities as a nation. And, you know, you guys who have been getting all this free stuff, you're going to have to give up some of it. And we're going to have to actually, you know, build the things to defend the Russians right. and the Chinese and the North Koreans. And do we have that capability?
Right. Well, that's obviously a political discussion. I doubt that there's the will there to make that kind of trade, short of a military conflict that makes it obvious. Right. We've done that in the past when there's been an obvious need. So until that need becomes manifest, then I don't know that we're going to make that kind of trade. But from the DOD perspective, you have to focus on what is within your realm of control, right? So the DOD has got to think, well, we're going to be within a certain budget envelope going forward. Even if it does grow a little bit, it won't be a lot. And we probably have to think about recapitalizing the nuclear triad and investing in new nuclear capabilities within some constrained part of that envelope. And you bring up the 7% number, which is, you know, accurate, but then it doesn't take into account the fact that right now we're recapitalizing the nuclear triad, which is taking a lot of procurement money and R&D money. And if you look at just the Navy shipbuilding budget, Columbia takes up a quarter of it. It's not always going to take up a quarter of it. That's only for about 10 or 15 years of time. And then the rest of the time, you basically go for another 35 or 25 years before you have to replace it. But for now, the nuclear recapitalization has taken a big chunk of the procurement budget, which is going to impact our ability to procure other things like conventional platforms, ships and aircraft. And the other thing to think about is a huge chunk of the DOD budget is already spoken for. So when we say 7% goes to the nuclear triad, that's true. But in the rest of the budget, there's not a lot of wiggle room. There's the O&M budget, the operations and maintenance budget, takes up, depending on which service it is, a quarter or a third of the budget. You've got personnel, which takes up another quarter to a third of the budget. And that's all spoken for because you can't just not maintain the force, and you can't pay people, or you got to pay people. You cannot pay people. So that starts to really shrink the trade space that the service has. So you have to really think of is the nuclear triad recapitalization in that trade space, and what priority does it occupy relative to conventional systems?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, it seems that, you know, as you look at the DOD, we're over time getting less for more. You know, the Navy is the combatant vessels are we have the fewest we've had in, since World War II, I think. It's the smallest combat Navy we've had. You know, I remember whenever I pre-commissioned the USS Ramage, and And, you know, that the Navy, we were going to go to 400 or 500 ships at that time. And now we can't maintain 300. So, and we're going to have 12 instead of 14 SSBNs. And we're shrinking, but we're spending more and more to do that. Is there a way, and you've been looking at this for, you know, I've been reading, you know, your reports for a decade or more. And is there a way to actually sort of, you know, no pun intended, turn the ship around and sort of get the DOD to where it, you know, it's, you know, can have 600, you know, I just wrote an article about putting bombers back on alert. And I was looking at, you know, the end of the Cold War, where were we? And then where are we now? And it's been shrink for 30 years, but the costs have not gone down, and procurement costs to get less are way higher. So, you know, we've got all these problems. We're at a really difficult time. How do we do more?
Right. This is obviously something I've been writing on for probably a decade now about. And also I testified about this issue a couple of weeks ago at the House Oversight Committee. And the main issue is that we have to change what we buy, right? Because the big problem is every new platform has to be better than the last one. Every new ship and aircraft has to be a quantum leap in capability compared to its predecessor. We can't contain ourselves. We can't control our appetite for new requirements. And so you end up with the new program always being much more sophisticated and much more technology focused. And therefore, you're usually getting ahead of where technology can deliver today. So now there's research and development involved to deliver the technologies that are needed in this new aircraft or ship. And we create a situation where not only is it more expensive because it's more capable, but it's also taking longer to develop. And we potentially then build in more costs because of those delays. And at the end, you end up with a smaller number of platforms to replace something that you had today. That cycle repeats itself through the DOD innumerable times. And we have to break that chain, right? We have to stop that cycle of needing ever more sophisticated capabilities every time we start a new program. And there are some examples where the DOD has started to try to curb that appetite, but usually with the help of Congress. So F-15EX is a great example of where the Air Force was forced to deliver a new aircraft that was a good improvement on its predecessor, but it was a very different alternative to the F-35 that was cheaper and easier to deliver on time. You're going to see probably other services have to do a similar retrenchment to their requirements process to come up with systems that are more affordable and are delivering relevant capability, but you can deliver them at relevant scale. You know, instead of it just being the best thing ever, it's got to be something I can build enough of to be useful. And that means I probably have to have it be affordable. And that means I probably have to make the requirements less than I could if I was really trying to pace the or to exceed the threat.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the F-16 a great example? I mean, we've you know, had spiral development and block development, and it's, you know, it's gotten a lot better over time. It's remained a relatively affordable aircraft, and, you know, it seems that we could do that. You know, like LRSO is another great example. It's on time, it's under budget. And, you know, it's one of the few things where we're, you know, in that kind of a position. Are there other ways, you know, we need acquisition reform. I one time, maybe 10 years ago, did an acquisition reform study when I was at the Air Force Research Institute. And what we did is we started looking, and we found that within the decade prior, there had already been 156 acquisition reform studies. So we were like, well, we already know everything we need to know to fix acquisition. And then here we are 10 years hence, and we still have the same problems.
Right.
If we want to build the kind of nuclear force we need for the threats we need, the conventional capability for the threats we face, is there some way that we can do this?
Yeah, I think the problem lies much more on the requirement side than the acquisition side. Yeah. We seem to have a lot of paths to be able to more efficiently buy new gear, whether that's through commercial acquisition like Defense Innovation Unit does, or through middle tier of acquisition where we do essentially competitive prototyping and come up with the best of breed and begin to procure that at scale. The acquisition side seems to have a lot of opportunity for being able to do things in an affordable and timely way. It's on the requirement side that we typically fail because we aim too high. We try to incorporate technologies that aren't mature. We have this system where the warfighter, the operator, defines what they want, which is usually, you know, setting the bar very high, as opposed to the warfighter having to work with the program manager and come up with what's feasible with today's level of technology, and that's likely to be affordable in the numbers that the program manager has been tasked to buy, because you can't, you know, have the thing be a gold-plated system if you're going to buy them in large numbers. And that drives us to maybe thinking differently about the overall design of the force, because if I'm going to have a larger number of these less sophisticated things, and probably unmanned things, then I can maybe complement those with a smaller number of the higher-end gold-plated things. And then that force mix gives you the capability you need and the adaptability you need and the scale you need. But it's not like everything's a Death Star. Everything's got to be, you got to have probably a heterogeneity of the force.
So I was reading Elon Musk's book a few months back, and one of the things he said that he did at Tesla was that he made designers and engineers work on the same team. Because historically, the designers design, then they throw it over the wall to the engineers, and the engineers have to figure out how to build it.
Right.
So when you talk about setting requirements and that's the fundamental problem, is it that we don't have designers and, you know, engineers working together? Is it that, you know, you set requirements and then you throw it over the wall, and then the primes, you know, they have to say, oh, geez, man, how do we actually build this? Is it sort of like that, or how is it? And then how do we fix it?
Right. No, I think that's how it is. So, but if you look to take one good example, the B-21 is an example of doing that right. You're aware, Northrop Grumman and the program office were given a strict cost limitation. They had to buy, it'd be $550 million or less in, I think, FY10 dollars. And that constraint created the trade space. And so the program managers, the designers, the operators had to get together and come up with what was an acceptable set of requirements that could be achieved within that cost and with the technology that was going to be available, because you couldn't build a large R&D program and have that still be the cost of each aircraft. So that was a really good forcing function and forced this collaboration. I think an example of maybe where it didn't happen as much is in Colombia, where you did have the Navy sort of setting a very high bar with regard to things like survivability or quieting and a life of ship core for the reactor plant. A lot of requirements that, you know, made it very challenging from a technological standpoint, and we're going to make it expensive just to construct and to be able to field and sustain. So those things could have been, those were trade space, those are trade decisions. You didn't have to make it necessarily the way you did. You could have come up with different operational concepts for Columbia, where maybe it wasn't as quiet, but I was going to use other systems in conjunction with it to protect it from being detected. So there's other ways you can go about it, but it means you need to have that flexibility from the operator side in terms of how will this be used? What are the other systems it might be used with? The example of the F-15 is a good one, where the F-15 is not going to be as stealthy as an F-35 or an F-22, but you can use it in conjunction with long-range strike weapons and collaborative combat aircraft and achieve a lot of the same effects you could with an F-35. But it means you have to be flexible on the CONOPS, and you have to be flexible on the requirements to be able to meet that need for relevant capability and relevant scale.
Yeah, that's a... Do you think it's possible that we could do this? I mean, is it something we can actually do?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen the example with the B-21, rather, I think. I think, we've seen some examples where the services have been working in this direction. The Navy tried to do this with their frigate program by having a requirements evaluation team where the people that were defining the requirements worked with the program manager and worked with the shipyard to figure out what's the art of the possible and how could we build this ship and have it be affordable and build it on time. The process didn't yield the result that the Navy was hoping it did, and that's why the program's behind. But they at least had an idea that that's how they wanted to go build the requirements for the program. So we see it green shoots like this, where the department is starting to realize these big programs have to be built with having the cost constraints and technology constraints capacity, you know, floors all built into them. I can't have the thing be perfect, but I can only build three of them. I need to be able to bring that relevant capacity in as a driver of the trade space.
Yeah, that's a That's a fair point. You sort of spurred one question, and as I think to some of the Navy's more recent shipbuilding efforts in LCS and Zumwalt, which, you know, they both sort of seem to have been unsuccessful. Do you think that they've learned? Because I'm worried about the size of the combat Navy. Do you think they've learned enough from those recent examples to sort of avoid doing that again and build what, you know, the ships we need?
I mean, I think they've learned those lessons, but I don't know if they've applied them, because you can see in the frigate program, they applied the lessons from LCS and Zumwalt to say, we can't build requirements in a vacuum. We have to build the requirements with an understanding of what's possible with technology and how much things are going to cost and how many can I build and how long does it take to build them. That was all part of the discussion around these requirements and valuation teams. But then what happened at the end is the initial requirements captured that set of needs to make sure that it was not too expensive and not too sophisticated, and incorporated a lot of the common elements from the FREM frigate, which was the parent design they used. And then when it transitioned over to NAVC to turn into detailed requirements for construction, between NAVC and the shipyard, well, then the requirements again exploded and became, you know, much more stringent and therefore more expensive and difficult to achieve. So there's that need to, as you transition from kind of a conceptual design down to a detailed design for a new platform, keeping that mindset of it's got to be within a certain cost envelope and it has to be delivered in a certain time frame. But it still has to be relevant capability. And then what are the other things I can bring to bear in the operational concepts that allow it to be successful, even if the requirements are not as ambitious as they might have been to start with?
Yeah, it's a good point. That's a fair point. Now, we're at that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie, who, whenever I rub my magic lamp, Bob gives all of our guests three wishes, but those wishes have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. And, you know, it's funny for the listeners, you know, you and I talked before the show to sort of say what set the parameters for what we were going to talk about. And, you know, we sort of went in a totally different direction. So as you make your wishes, you can make wishes related to what we were originally going to talk about, which was more NATO and Asia focused. But I'll turn it over to you. So, Brian, what is your first wish?
I guess my first wish would be that the DoD would largely eliminate the joint requirements process and eliminate most of the service requirements processes and focus that discussion about the conceptual design or the conceptual need for a new program around force planning and force design. You know, so instead of thinking of a platform as an independent piece of the force that operates in isolation, instead think of where it fits in the overall force design and let that be the thing that drives the trade space, and then go into the acquisition process where we'll go through a whole set of requirements development to support acquisition. But in a lot of ways, the basic parameters around a new program are defined by what's the budget for it, where does it fit into the Navy or into the service's overall force design, you know, and what are the missions it needs to do. You don't need to have a long requirements process to do that. And then you go right to acquisition, where we have a discussion about what's the art of the possible to build this platform within that trade space. So that'd be the first thing.
And who's going to hate that, your idea, the most?
Well, I think the joint staff, because that's in a lot of ways their job is to manage requirements. And then I think also the some of the uniform side leadership or service leaders who feel like they need to put some guardrails on what the acquisition people can do. And I think a lot of times those guardrails are just so ambitious that the acquisition people are left with no options other than just to defer programs into the future because they don't have enough money and enough technology to deliver them at the time they're supposed to.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good one. That's a good one. You know, I'm sort of glad we went in this other direction because this is a topic we haven't really talked about that much. So it was sort of actually really quite useful. Okay. So that's wish number one. So what's wish number two?
I'd wish for the department to rethink its triad recapitalization plan in light of the growing diversity of threats that it faces. Because I think, you know, the Triad was a great tool when we dealt with a Soviet threat that was, you know, pretty well defined, but, you know, it was diverse in its own way. But now you've got multiple countries with nuclear weapons, all threatening U.S. allies who depend on us for extended deterrence. We need to think about maybe the Triad is not the right approach. Maybe we need like a sea-based leg and an air-based leg that's got multiple different weapons. But then we need to add to that submarine-launched tactical nuclear weapons, so submarine-launched nuclear cruise missile, and add to that more forward-deployed nuclear weapons that might be on allied territory, because that might affect enemy decision-making. And those investments to make that a workable system might require rethinking how big do we make the Sentinel program and how much do we really recapitalize the nuclear leg of the Triad. So I think I wish the department would, you know, rethink how it's going to pursue this Triad recapitalization in light of the growing diversity of threats.
Yeah, it would be interesting, you know, to have a study that says if we start from scratch, what would we build? Because we never do that. We just say, okay, let's build the newest version of this thing we already have. Right. Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing it. So you got to hear, folks, Brian Clark says we need Pershing 3.
That's right.
Okay, so you get one more wish. What's your final wish?
I wish the department would re-examine force design, or return to force design, as a major effort within each of the services. I've seen the Air Force mounted a pretty significant effort under General Brown to rethink how it designed its force, to look at how the pieces work together. The Navy is trying to do that right now. The Marines did a big force design effort, which I thought yielded some very interesting and useful results. The Army has not yet mounted it, but they've talked about doing it. But thinking about how the service needs to design itself for the future instead of just sort of recapitalizing what it has, and thinking about how all the parts work together. Because you could see, and we did a study on this recently, the idea that maybe the core multi-mission kind of traditional forces that we've grew up with in the Cold War and beyond, maybe that piece of the force obviously has a lot of utility, right? That's what you need for crisis response. We're using that to defend Israel from Iranian proxies right now. But does it need to be as big as it is? And do we need to maybe have it, let it get a little bit smaller, and then build on top of that what we called hedge forces, or elements of the force that are targeted against a particular scenario or a particular region or a particular threat that are more specialized and maybe even forward deployed? To try to make it so that the force has the requisite utility in different situations without having to grow the military by two times to try to make it able to do all the different things it might be pressed to do. So this idea of rethinking force design and making that a core element of how the services build their requirements going forward.
Yeah, that's a good one. I liked all three. I'll do my best to convince Bob to grant you all three wishes.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time for this episode of NucleCast. So, Brian Clark, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. It was great to be here.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we'll see you next time. Great discussion with Brian Clark. You know, we talked before the show, and we were actually going to talk about NATO mostly, and you know, some of the recent changes that NATO's been undertaking, but you know, he sort of went in a direction of acquisition, and I followed him, and then the conversation changed, and I actually thought it changed for the better, because I enjoyed the discussion about acquisition and procurement. So hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.